allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
Palestinians in the occupied Ramallah took to the streets in support of more than 4,500 prisoners who are facing strict punitive measures and collective punishment by Israeli prison authorities. Recently, the prisoners have taken a series of actions against new restrictions imposed on them by Israeli authorities. Prisoners' advocacy groups who organized the protest described the prisoners' actions as an uprising or intifada.
I prefer to call it the prisoners' intifada or uprising because the inmates face daily assault caused by the prison administration, who is seeking to destroy their collective efforts over the years that aim to improve living conditions in detention.
Tensions in Israeli prisons have escalated since September 2021, following the escape of six prisoners from the Gilboa High Security Jail. Although they were caught after a massive manhunt, Israeli officials implemented several punitive measures against the remaining detainees, such as banning visits and reducing their yard time, which led to clashes and strikes.
The prisoners are our red line. We will not allow prison authorities to cross it, and we will not remain silent on these punitive measures against our freedom fighters. And we know at the end of the day they will achieve victory as they did in previous battles. The prison administration knows very well what it's doing will only lead to more tension.
As part of those actions taken by the prisoners since January the 1st, some 500 detainees have been boycotting the Israeli military court system to protest their imprisonment under the so-called administrative detention. Today, some 4,500 Palestinians are held in Israeli prisons, including 180 children and 34 women. Palestinians hail them as freedom fighters.
Prisoners' advocacy groups say 2022 has been worse for the Palestinian prisoners so far, and the inmates themselves believe that they are in need of such solidarity protests because the worst is yet to come in the wake of the escalating tough measures by the Israeli prison authorities. Mona Kandil, occupied Ramallah.
Following the recent retaliatory attacks by the Yemeni army and its aerial strikes on Saudi Arabia and the United Arab Emirates, the United Nations Security Council imposed an arms embargo on Yemen's Ansarullah movement. This measure was proposed by the UAE in an attempt to curtail the military capabilities of the Yemeni army.
Arms embargo on Yemen is not new. As everyone knows, we are prohibited from even buying fuel, foodstuffs. Today, Yemenis are suffering from a severe fuel crisis due to the seizure of Yemeni oil ships by the Saudi-led coalition. The Yemeni army depends on the Yemeni military industries, which have proven to the world the growing military capabilities of Yemen. This resolution will not stop the Yemeni missile attacks, but rather will prompt the Yemeni army to intensify its retaliatory operations.
In a Twitter post, the member of Yemen's Supreme Political Council, Muhammad Ali al-Houthi, criticized the measure, saying it has ignored war crimes by the Saudi-led coalition. He noted that any arms embargo that does not apply to the Western-backed coalition has no value.
The Security Council's resolution will not affect Yemen in facing the Saudi-led war. The Yemeni army continues to make progress on all battlefronts, and this measure is only aimed at satisfying Saudi Arabia and its allies. The resolution also aims to prolong the war on Yemen and halt any move toward peace. We, as the Yemeni people, are besieged. Our airports and ports are closed, and we cannot buy weapons like other countries. So this decision will not have any effect.
Saudi Arabia's allies have launched a deadly war on Yemen since the beginning of 2015, killing tens of thousands of civilians, many of them women and children. This has pushed the Yemeni army to escalate its retaliatory attacks against Saudi and Emirati territories.
Experts say the Yemeni army depends on local military industries in addition to the spoils of war left by the Saudi-led coalition's forces after escaping the battlefront. They believe that the UN resolution will make no difference as Yemen is besieged by Saudi Arabia since the beginning of the war. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Images may soon be a thing of the past if Brussels has its way and removes Russian-backed media RT and Sputnik and their subsidiaries from the airwaves. British ministers have already written to the UK's media regulator, Ofcom, asking it to review RT's license to broadcast in the country.
In another unprecedented step, we will ban in the European Union the Kremlin's media machine.
Social media platforms with headquarters in the West could soon follow suit and bar pro-Russian sites and commentators from their platforms. This unprecedented move by the EU is supposed to combat what it's calling Russian propaganda about the war. But analysts warn that this step will only further highlight the double standards that exist when it comes to the issue of freedom of speech. The hypocrisy of the move being pushed by the EU is not lost on media commentators.
I think it's blatant censorship. And the European Union and the Western world in general always bangs on about, you know, freedom of speech and democracy. And that's one of the cornerstones of their societies. And this is blatantly censoring opinions they don't like. And it's as simple as that, really. It's incredibly hypocritical. It's incredibly disappointing. The reaction of Western mainstream media journalists is also incredibly disappointing because a lot of them are cheerleading for this.
With tensions surrounding the Ukraine conflict building, there are questions being raised about the way mainstream Western outlets have been covering this crisis. For some analysts, the move to ban Russian media is part of a strategy to ensure the public has access to only one overriding narrative.
The censoring of media outlets, the sending of arms to Ukraine. These kind of things would not be allowed or accepted by Western public opinions if there wasn't this massive disinformation campaign and propaganda campaign against Russia, which has been ongoing for many years now.
With the media war almost as important as the physical conflict being waged, the West is very much aware of the significance of stifling Russian voices at this time. But observers are asking, at what cost? Amina Taylor, London.
The Prophet of Mercy, a sequel to the 2015 letters written by leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, to the Western youth in the wake of the Charlie Hebdo attacks in Paris, imploring them to learn about the Muslim faith from its original sources.
And one of the key things in the book he talks about is education. And when you have education, you're able to talk to somebody, even if you don't agree with their point of view, but at least you can converse with them. And I think that with the lack of education, lack of respect for somebody else, or lack of understanding of somebody else's point of view, results in violence or results in people taking the law into their own hands. We don't want that.
Translated into multiple languages, the 196-page book elaborates on the life of Muhammad, the holy prophet of Islam.
I think the book is trying to say to us we need to relook at his life in the manner looking at social cohesion, looking at the concept of brotherhood, looking at the concept of unity, looking at the concept of how we should resolve our problems together.
1,400 years ago, Prophet Muhammad was born in Mecca, Saudi Arabia, and went on to change the course of history. For 1.5 billion Muslims, he is the last and greatest of that long line of prophets who have brought the word of God to humanity. Today, Islam and its followers are on the receiving end of some of the most vicious attacks, all for the appalling acts of a few.
It is quite overt, and the paradox that Muslims are often accused of terrorism, whereas they're in fact amongst the prime victims of terrorism, because they do get attacked by fanatics and extremists all the time.
Prophet Muhammad laid the foundation for the religion of Islam that after his death developed a culture and civilization
that spread around the world, inspiring hundreds of millions.
At a time when many in the West, under the influence of the mainstream media, see Islam as a violent, intolerant faith, it is hoped that publications such as this one will shed light on true Islam and win hearts and minds. Saeed Pourrezzah, London.
He is referred to as the head of ambassadors in Iran. Salah al-Zawawi has retired after completing his 40th year as the Palestinian ambassador to Iran. He finished his tenure in January when he was succeeded by his daughter, Salam al-Zawawi. Here at the Tehran office of the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the former Palestinian envoy was honored for his four decades of activities. Following the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran ended its alliance with Israel and officially recognized Palestine as a state. This was followed by shutting down the Israeli embassy in Tehran and turning it over to the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Al-Zawawi was among a delegation headed by then PLO chief Yasser Arafat, who came to Iran days after the revolution and symbolically took over the keys of the embassy. Al-Zawawi is one of the founding members of Fatah political party and the second Palestinian ambassador to Iran since the 1979 Islamic Revolution. He has held the post since 1981, and before that, he served as the Palestinian ambassador to Algeria, Brazil, and Kenya. Throughout his career, Al-Zawawi took major steps to shed light on the Israeli occupation of Palestine, which has been ongoing for more than seven decades.
After four decades of serving as Palestine's envoy to Iran, Salah al-Zawawi is now retiring. But unlike any other ambassador, he's not going to live his retired life in his home country, as he's one of the millions of Palestinian diaspora who are denied the right to return to their homeland. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
If passed, the Borders and Nationality Bill will give the UK government the power to jail asylum seekers for up to 4 years if they arrive via sea routes like the English Channel, and others could be sent to a third country for processing and detention. The devolved nations Scotland and Wales have already rejected it as an anti-refugee bill, and people on the streets of London are demanding Westminster do the same.
They're putting legislation in protest in place so that they can put guns on our beaches. That's what they want to do, because the migrants that will be coming when the climate and the ecological emergency really begins to hit, we want to welcome and they want to keep out.
Britain's banks, its military, its companies across the world creating poverty, creating destruction and warfare. And when people try to flee from the consequences of that, Britain puts up fences, borders, guards to keep people out.
The bill also gives the government extraordinary powers when it comes to ethnic minorities in the UK. A proposed rule change quietly added to the bill will give the Home Secretary draconian powers over immigrants, first, second and third generation alike.
The fact of the matter is you can be born and bred legally in the UK, but if you have dual citizenship or can claim citizenship somewhere else, the British government might give itself permission to strip you of your British citizenship. In short, you're not British enough. You're a second-class citizen.
Once you are a citizen, you have the right to remain a citizen. I mean, there's many incidents. That young woman in Syria, that's such an important precedent. They groomed her. She should be brought home. She should be looked after. This is, in any other situation, this would be considered child abuse.
Shamima Begum was 15 years old when she left the UK for Syria, where she was absorbed by the Daesh terrorist group. As a second-generation Bangladeshi, she has been stripped of her citizenship and is still languishing in a Syrian refugee camp.
These are the most racist pieces of legislation we've seen in the UK in modern British history. They constitute a direct infringement on every minority's rights, giving the right for a politician to take away our citizenship and giving the government overwhelming power to decide immigration policy. We're resisting today, we'll resist tomorrow, and we invite the country to resist alongside us.
Under the new bill, the government would no longer have to inform someone they are about to lose their citizenship. This will make appealing the decision almost impossible. Rights groups say these measures are used mainly against British Muslims, but Black and Asian Britons also say they now live in fear. Bianca Rahimi, London.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
At the end of the day, the US-Israel alliance is a lot stronger than any notion of democracy or human rights, says Jessica Boxbaum, journalist, in an article published under the heading, Biden administration's reluctance to spend geopolitical capital greenlights Israeli settlement push. Stay tuned for more. Recently, the Zionist regime bowed to American pressure and scrapped the controversial Atarot settlement in the Palestinian neighborhood of Ghalandia, just north of Al-Quds. But on the heels of that decision, the regime advanced another Jewish settlement in Palestinian neighborhoods along Al-Quds' southern tip, even as the residents there are grappling with a severe housing shortage. The plan is to develop a new neighborhood called Givat HaShaked on land expanding beyond the Green Line, the Zionist regime's de facto border before the 1967 war, which saw it occupy its Al-Quds, the West Bank, and the Gaza Strip, and adjacent to the Palestinian neighborhood of Beit Safafa in occupied East Al-Quds. Recently, the Al-Quds Municipality Planning and Building Committee recommended the development plan for deposit, meaning it will now head to Al-Quds District Planning Committee, which will decide whether to deposit the plan for objections or public review. The project calls for construction of 473 homes, schools, and synagogues to be built on about 9 acres of open land. During the committee hearing, the Zionist regime's custodian general, the authority within the Justice Ministry overseeing properties whose owners are unknown, was represented by its economic unit director, Hanel Gorfinkel. Gorfinkel is a right-wing activist known for supporting Jewish settlement in East Al-Quds. Givat HaShaked is not the only settlement in East Al-Quds being pushed by the custodian general. Documentation obtained by Haaretz reveals Givat HaShaked is one of 6 Jewish neighborhoods the Zionist regime is currently advancing across East Al-Quds. These include one in Sheikh Jarrah, one near Damascus Gate, one in Sur Bahr, one in Beit Haniya, and another in Beit Safafa. Activists emphasize that Gorin Fekel's appointment is directly intertwined with the heightened settlement activity and the displacement of Palestinians in East Al-Quds. Amy Cohen, Director of International Relations and Advocacy at Al-Quds-focused Israeli human rights organization Er Amim, said of Gor Finkel, "What we have seen is that since his appointment in 2017, there has been a substantial increase in eviction lawsuits against Palestinians and the expansion of Jewish settlements in Palestinian areas." According to Er Amim, the acreage set for Givat HaShaked is actually on land that is undergoing formal land registration in Sharafat area of Beit Safafa. The Zionist regime's 2018 decision 3790 was marketed to the public as a means to push economic development in East Al-Quds and reduce socioeconomic inequality. The initiative reserved 50 million shekels, nearly $16 million, for the registration of land rights in East Al-Quds, an important prerequisite needed to secure building permits. The Zionist regime authorities often use the absence of building permits as justification for demolishing Palestinian homes. However, as uncovered by Er Amim, land registration procedures are being used to advance Jewish settlements as found in Sheikh Jarrah, rather than develop Palestinian neighborhoods in Al-Quds. On one hand, Decision 3790 is depicted as a tool to aid Palestinians, Cohen told Min Press News, adding, "And yet it's being used to further the expansion of Jewish settlement and confiscation of Palestinian land and property. Land registration is supposed to be a transparent and publicized process," Sari Kronish, East Al-Quds planner at Israeli Regime Planning Rights Organization BIMCOM, explained. "The regime is supposed to publish a map of areas of the plots and invite people to make claims. And if claims are made that contradict each other, then the registrar is supposed to send those claims to court to be clarified," Kronish said, adding, "But the way the regime is actually doing it, we see that it's being done quietly. People often don't know that's happening. We don't know yet of a single case where the Palestinians will be able to benefit from it," Kronish added. The area reserved for Givat HaShaked was once sought after for development by former Zionist regime Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin. In 1995, Rabin put forward a housing project for the land, sparking international outcry. The UN Security Council voted to have the Zionist regime halt the plan, with the United States vetoing the resolution. Rabin shelved his expropriation days after the UN vote in what has been speculated to be an exchange for the US veto. Now the current Zionist regime is going beyond what any previous leadership dared to. Daniel Scheidman, founder and director of Israeli nonprofit Terrestrial Al-Quds, emphasized. "These settlement plans are now on the agenda," Scheidman told Min Press News, adding, "Relations between the United States and Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett are charged at the moment." Scheidman continued, "The Americans have made their concerns very clear about the settlement of E1 and Atarot, so Why is Bennett having another poke in the eye over something like this? Lara Friedman, president of the American Nonprofit Foundation for Middle East Peace, FMEP, agreed the new government is stepping into territory even Bennett's predecessor wouldn't touch. They are as bad as the Benjamin Netanyahu cabinet, and in many ways, they are worse, Friedman said, adding, these settlements are absolutely incompatible with any commitment to anything other than permanent Israeli control over the entire area, Friedman added, highlighting the record number of home demolitions throughout Area C of the occupied West Bank as another way Bennett's cabinet is pushing increased annexation. From Er Amim's Cohen's perspective, despite Bennett's cabinet being a politically diverse coalition, hardline voices are the ones in power. Far-right members of the coalition are put in very strategic high-level positions like in the Ministry of Interior, Ministry of Housing, Ministry of Finance, Ministry of Justice, Cohen said. All of these portfolios are very senior and they have a lot of weight. And what we have seen is because of this, they're quietly able to advance this very far-right wing agenda. Prominent right-wing politicians hold top spots in Israel's cabinet. Ayelet Shaked is Interior Minister. Zeev Elkin is the Minister of Housing and Construction. And Gideon Saar serves as the Minister of so-called Justice. As settlement expansion becomes the defining feature of Bennett's regime, the other side of the Atlantic is becoming increasingly more vocal about the Zionist occupation and land theft. In November 26, U.S. House Democrats penned a letter urging Secretary of State Antony Blinken to stop the Zionist regime from moving forward with a settlement plan in E1 area of the West Bank. The move was led by Wisconsin Representative Mark Pocan, who recently toured a Palestinian village in the West Bank with New York Representative Jamal Bowman. And Minnesota Representative Betty McCollum has become a strong advocate for Palestinian rights in Congress. The Democrat has sponsored two bills related to U.S. military aid to the Zionist regime and said the state practices apartheid. On the Givat HaShaket proposal, an ongoing settlement expansion in Palestine, McCollum told Min Press in a statement, the Zionist regime's state-sponsored expansion of settlements on Palestinian land, while the Israeli cabinet bureaucrats deny Palestinian permits to even build homes and bulldoze existing Palestinian homes, schools, and businesses, is destroying the prospect of a Palestinian state and the prospects for peace. The global community views the Israeli settlement expansion as illegal and lethal to any future peace process, and the U.S. government should not be silent. The situation has reached a point in which the Palestinians are clearly a people denied even basic human rights while under Israeli regime subjugation. U.S. lawmakers are emerging as more and more critical of Israeli regime, but that hasn't stopped the Israeli regime violence. In fact, the Zionist regime appears almost fueled by the condemnation. But at the end of the day, the U.S.-Israel alliance is a lot stronger than any notion of democracy or human rights. No U.S. administration wants to be perceived as picking 10 fights every day with Israel, even if Israel is engaging every day in 10 things that really demand a response from the U.S.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Welcome to Spotlight. A hoax plan for so-called extremists to take over a number of British schools highlight the issue of institutionalized Islamophobia in the UK, and now victims of the government-backed Islamophobic purge are calling for justice and a fresh, independent inquiry. In this edition of Spotlight, we'll look at the different aspects of this scandal, as well as the role and goals of the British government in promoting Islamophobia.
The Muslim Council of Britain has demanded an independent public inquiry be launched to get to the bottom of who was behind the hoax extremism plot letter which ruined the lives of so many Muslim teachers. The call comes amid rising pressure on Government Minister Michael Gove, who was named and shamed as a key component which turned the bogus plot into a nationwide Islamophobic witch hunt in Birmingham.
It all started when a letter detailing an alleged extremism plot to take over and radicalise Muslim-majority schools in Birmingham was circulated by the press. Mr Gove, who was in office at the time, was aware of the letter, was warned that it's a hoax, yet decided to disregard the advice and pushed ahead with it anyway, adding fuel to the fire. It's believed that it might be his own personal prejudices against Muslims that fueled this decision, based on the fact that he's written material in the past that's been considered deeply Islamophobic.
B spoke to several victims of the witch hunt earlier this week. They are hopeful for legal retribution.
The allegations against us were based on hearsay. The statements that were given by anonymous witnesses weren't substantiated, they weren't corroborated. Yet on the back of these allegations, our careers and lives were ruined, and we were ostracized. I was ostracized, demonized, vilified, seen as the bad guy.
A public apology for his actions, followed by a change in policy, because the actions that followed what was perceived to be a sinister plot on part of Muslim teachers, governors, and I was included within that bracket, that all of that was a complete fabrication and a lie. And so there has to be a public apology, and B, a rescinding of the policies that subsequently followed.
Apart from the racist and Islamophobic aspects at play, the Trojan Horse scandal was used as a pretext to enforce controversial counter-extremism policies which have penalised Muslims ever since. Press TV contacted Mr Gove's office for comment but received no reply. But with demands for answers growing, how long can the silence remain? Robert Carter, London.
Well, joining us on Spotlight, we have Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, and head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajari, who's joining us from London.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Let's start with Yvonne Ridley in Jedburgh. Ms. Ridley, it's great to have you with us. It's been years since we last spoke. So Demands for an independent inquiry into Britain's Trojan horse scandal have grown after this podcast recently highlighted several unanswered questions from the entire saga. So after so many years, why are there still so many unanswered questions?
Well, because as we've already heard in that excellent report by Robert Carter, that the whole Trojan horse affair was one big hoax. But it didn't stop the government and ministers like Michael Gove acting as though this was a very real threat. And as a result, decisions taken affected all of the state-funded education in England and Wales. And there was a McCarthy-style witch hunt. But instead of people looking for reds under the bed, they were seeing Muslim extremists where there were none. Like all injustices, the Trojan horse affair cast a long shadow over Muslim communities. And the real losers were people like the one that we just heard, whose lives and careers were ruined by the Trojan horse affair. But also the long-term losers have been Muslim children in those schools, not just in Birmingham. This is right across England. I spoke to somebody today who was a school governor in Bradford who was edged out because people were seeing extremists everywhere where there were actually none. This whole affair has damaged people's lives, damaged careers, damaged the education in England and Wales. It's been very destructive. It's cast a very long shadow, and the government must be held to account. Good that the Muslim Council of Britain is calling for justice, but also ordinary members of the public have taken it upon themselves to sign a petition and try and force the issue to be debated in the House of Commons.
Masud Shajara, in 2017, the cases against the teachers collapsed, but their defense has never been heard to this day. Who should be responsible for this? Who should compensate, basically, the individuals that bore the brunt of this fabricated scenario? Despite numerous government reports, parliamentary hearings, and an array of legal processes, why has the truth been so hard to pin down?
Well, what was being accused was that the Muslim community or certain members of Muslim community are coordinating, organizing to take over the education and divert and brainwash the children, not just Muslim children, but children. But the reality was that the only people who were getting together to converse and create a coordinated effort to do damage and do unlawful things was Mr. Gove and his colleagues. You know, he brought Peter Clark, which was the ex-head of the anti-terrorism of Metropolitan Police, with no expertise in trying to actually unleash whatever was happening or what was being accused within the schools. But his expertise was to always see a Muslim wrongdoers around the corner. And this is why he was brought in. I mean, it is very important to remind the viewers that what happened prior to this was these schools which were turned around. They were failing the schools. They were turned around by this team of dedicated Muslims, not just for the Muslim children, but for everyone. So here was actually a solution to the problems of education in inner cities, which the Muslims rose up and start addressing. And actually, they were commanded for this. And then because of a fraud, someone took a position of writing a false letter, and everyone, Gove as a minister and indeed everybody else in authority, jump on that bandwagon and demonize the whole of the Muslim community, disassociated Muslims for being involved in the future of the children, their children, and indeed other children. And that sort of process of helping the education within inner city, turning failing schools into actually a proper school, was totally lost to the Muslim children and indeed everybody else. And I would say that on top of the fact that we have to blame the institutionalized Islamophobia, which is definitely behind this, we also have to blame the Muslim community and Muslim community institutions, because they failed to rise up and help and support not just these teachers, but stop the demonization of whole of the Muslim community. Their failure at the time, it really is very worrying. When you compare the currently Sikh council sort of on the immigration bill, turning around to all the members of parliament and saying that anyone who's voted for this racist bill will be welcome to go into any of the temples, the Muslim councils actually failed miserably to support and indeed stand up against this institutional Islamophobia.
Ms. Ridley, you were nodding there when we were listening to Mr. Shajada. How do you perceive the role of the government in this scandal? And more importantly, what was the end result of it?
Well, I agreed with most of what Masood said, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community. The Muslims in Britain, ever since 9/11, have been put under the cosh. There's been paranoia displayed towards Muslims. Islamophobia has been fueled, and this race hate has really been directed at the Muslim community. Muslims back in that period, about a decade after 9/11, they felt under fire and had lost a lot of the confidence that they used to have. So when there was this deluge of criticism directed towards the schools about these Muslim fundamentalists creeping into the education system and trying to push extremist views onto the children, they just believed it. And of course, it was one big lie pushed conveniently by Michael Gove, who was one of the most Islamophobic ministers in this government, a government which has a reputation these days for pushing out lies on an almost daily basis. But what is also important in this, while Michael Gove was pushing this, he also used this fake letter as an excuse to roll out some extreme counter-terrorism measures, such as the notorious, now discredited, Prevent strategy in schools, which turned every teacher, every teaching assistant, even parents into spies, which again undermined the confidence of the community.
Indeed.
You know, children were, any children that showed, say, support for Palestine were reported to the Prevent scheme. Millions of pounds was poured into this discredited scheme while the education budgets were creaking along and not able to perform. So there was a big domino effect in this, but I wouldn't blame the Muslim community as a whole.
Okay, Mr. Shajada, you can also respond to that. That's exactly where I was going next. As a result of the government responded by implementing the so-called anti-terrorism prevent strategy in schools, it also made it a requirement for all schools to promote fundamental British values. Is religious intolerance being promoted in Britain?
Well, unfortunately, you know, we know that this government, and indeed the rest of Europe, the governments, and we are seeing sort of similar thing happening in France, Germany, and elsewhere. There is institutional Islamophobia, and the demonization of Muslim has become the norm, and we are in this environment of hate against Muslims. And the problem is this, that, you know, there is amnesia within those who are head of the so-called leadership of the Muslim community. And every time any incident happens, there seems to be somebody comes and push a button of reset button. And we forget about everything that has happened in past. And we're forgetting that we are living in this environment. And then we get letters from the Muslim Council of writing to MPs and thanking them. I don't know for what, for the fact that they're not addressing the ever-increasing Islamophobia. And we need to be extremely critical of this Islamophobic government, which is actually more Islamophobic than previous one, and there's no doubt about that. But at the same time, we need to actually be internally criticizing ourselves, because our institutions are not fit for purpose. They still want to rub shoulder, and they think that they get influence by having a cup of tea or rubbing shoulders with a minister or two. And I think, you know, Yvonne knows this very well. I remember, Yvonne, you raised that once in a meeting we were to one of the very senior police officers. You know this, I know this, and unless we tackle this, unless we actually stand up with the situation is as bad as it is now, we need to be fit for that purpose. And that means we need to stand up not just for protecting the Muslim community, which needs to be protected, but the whole community, because this environment of hate is so poisonous that actually affects everyone, Muslims and non-Muslims. See what happened in former Yugoslavia. See what has happened previously in other structures when these level of demonization have been unchecked.
Ms. Ridley, the effects of such affairs, such sagas, they are all-encompassing. 8 years on, this Trojan horse affair remains perhaps the best known and most polarizing story about Britain's relationship with its Muslim citizens. What have the British public, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, learned from all of this?
Well, sadly, I would think that the majority of the British public outside of the Muslim community are not aware of this excellent Trojan Horse podcast, which has been produced by the New York Times. Why is it that this excellent piece of investigative journalism and great expose has come from America? Because it should have come from the British media, but unfortunately, the British media is also institutionally racist and Islamophobic, and you know, this is where we have a problem. And what I would like to see the Muslim community do, not necessarily through the leadership of the MCB or any of these other Muslim organizations, is start to stand up. As I've often said, if you get up off your knees and stand up, the so-called great don't seem that great from that position. And so the Muslim community needs to get its confidence back. Maybe we should take a lead from the black communities in Brixton and in Toxteth. They got a lot of justice back through riots. I'm not suggesting Muslims rise up and take to the streets. You know, we have other mechanisms and other ways of making our points known. But maybe we should take a zero tolerance lead from the black community and be vocal and be robust and demand our rights. You know, human rights are for everyone in Britain, not just a few. And so this is something that we need to get a confidence back in the Muslim sure. community. That's what we need.
Mr. Shajare, is the British mainstream media Islamophobic? Does it promote Islamophobia?
Yes, of course it does. No, you know, they are promoting Islamophobia in many ways. The fact that this sort of a story doesn't break out, the fact that, you know, even when it breaks out, you know, nobody is calling for resignation of Gove, which if it was, you know, if the same treatment was dished out to any other community, they would have been called for resignation. And you know, shrinking spaces, sort of 10, 20 years ago, a Muslim community as a whole had a more voice, a very diverse voice in the British media. Now it doesn't. And you know, now it's even sort of Zionists speaking on behalf of the Muslims and everybody else, racist. So I actually agree with what Yvonne is saying. We need to be more confident in ourselves. The last conference, which was in January, on Islamophobia conference, which we held, we looked at how we could work with the establishment. Should we work with them? Yes, no, maybe. And we looked at the historical, and indeed we looked at the experience of the Black community, and we looked at it from a theological basis and everything. We need to revive the right of standing up to the bullies, because the bullies are taking over, and the government and the media are part of that bullying.
All right, thanks a lot. That's all the time we have for tonight's program. Allow me to thank my guests for the show tonight, Secretary General of the European Muslim League, Ms. Yvonne Ridley, joining us from Jedburgh, also head of the Islamic Human Rights Commission, Masoud Shajare, speaking to us from the British capital, London. And also a special thanks to you for staying with us on Spotlight. It's good night for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.